It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan in for Guy Raz.
And so I wasn't sure that I should actually come tonight.
Here's a speech President Barack Obama gave on a March evening a couple years ago at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington.
Biden talked me into it.
Journalists and politicians who attend this dinner call it nerd prom. It's black tie, there are a lot of drinks, lots of schmoozing, and the night is punctuated every year by a big funny speech from the president.
Besides, I happen to know that my approval ratings are still very high in the country of my birth.
But on this night, back in 2010, for a very small group of people who follow the world of national defense, people like Tom Juno of Esquire magazine, one of the president's jokes took on a very different meaning.
The Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. Sasha and Malia are huge fans, but boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you, predator drones. You will never see it coming.
I wasn't there for that moment, so it's hard for me to describe.
You think I'm joking?
But I can describe what I hear on the tape, which is, a man who has become quite accustomed to the use of that power, and an audience that is quite accustomed to him using that power to the extent that it's a laugh line.
You will never see it coming. You think I'm joking?
2 years later, this takes on a grim new meaning. Last fall, one casualty of the U.S.'s ramped-up use of drone warfare was a 16-year-old boy, a U.S. citizen, named Abdulrahman Al-Awlaki, as he sat around a campfire in Yemen. It's a story that represents what Tom Juno calls the lethal presidency. Just last week, Pakistani officials say 18 more people were killed by drones, including possibly a top commander of the Haqqani network. That's our cover story today, a look at the expansive, new, and often lethal power of the commander-in-chief and what that means in a presidential election year.
But
it's hard to know if the 16-year-old, Abdulrahman Al-Awlaki, was a target or collateral damage. These programs are top secret and rarely discussed in public. But we do know that the boy's father, an Al-Qaeda supporter, was killed in a drone strike just 2 weeks earlier in Yemen. The two of them, plus one other man, now make three U.S. citizens believed to have been killed by a U.S. drone.
And we have no idea why this happened, how this happened, what the standards were. We are kept completely in the dark.
Tom Juno argues in an era of drones and highly trained special forces, when the U.S. no longer fights countries but groups of people, the commander-in-chief now has unprecedented power to kill those people, not with an army sent to a rogue nation, but with technology, with drones or with elite special forces, targeting people individually. None of this has been confirmed by any official sources, only by anonymous government leaks, most notably to the New York Times, which reported earlier this summer that the president oversees secret kill lists of suspected terrorist leaders and makes the final call on whom to take out.
Nobody inherited that power when it was being used the way that Barack Obama did, and certainly nobody has expanded the use of that power the way he has. He's turned it from a power to a policy.
We'll take a look at what's behind this shift in policy with two experts on modern warfare. In a minute, Peter Singer of the Brookings Institution on the dramatic rise of armed drones. But first, Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, who's written about the rise of special operations forces. Part of that rise, he says, is a demand for less defense spending, smaller numbers of enlistees. But mostly, Schmidt says, it was a change set in motion after 9/11.
Right after 9/11, the immediate impact was, how do we get a force into Afghanistan? And the only force capable of going in quickly were a small number of American special operations forces. But as we saw over the decade, the special operations force, the number of personnel itself, is now about 66,000, which is roughly doubled since it was on 9/11 itself.
Wow, there's 66,000.
That's the actual
forces.
Number of people. That's civilians and military personnel. At any given time around the world today, there are about 12,000, basically, military personnel. deployed in over 70 countries. And so
that's
again,
a large group.
It is a large group. Their budget has increased to over $10 billion a year now, from just over $4 billion in 2011. As we see a downturn in defense spending overall, their budgets are actually going to stay roughly the same or maybe even increase a little bit. That's the premium that they're putting on.
Do you think there's something particular to President Obama that draws him to the use of special forces?
Well, again, I think this president has learned the lessons the hard way in many ways of large land deployments and the backlash that can cause in Muslim countries. I think the president has recognized and this administration has recognized, as the Bush administration did before them, the value that they bring, both in nightly combat or if it's in more far-flung countries where you're trying to introduce military skills, but on a smaller scale that doesn't necessarily attract attention and perhaps opposition.
There is also the other fear, though, that special forces can operate in a clandestine manner and perhaps without as much oversight. Is there a fear that in the future that this could ramp up to such a level that it could operate having to answer very few questions about what's happening and where it's happening?
Well, this is one of the interesting questions because some people complain about the militarization of the CIA, but other people have talked about the increasing covert nature of special operations forces and what they do. And unlike the CIA, when it carries out missions overseas, there is a very long-standing practice in law of reporting these operations to the Congress. The reporting requirements aren't quite as clear when it comes to special operations forces, particularly if they're operating in a covert type basis. So there are members of Congress that are seeking to clarify this as they anticipate the increased use of special operations forces for sensitive missions. I think this is something that won't be reversed no matter who wins the next election, because I think the special operations forces have demonstrated their flexibility and versatility in the type of missions that they can carry out.
Eric Schmidt covers national security and terrorism for the New York Times. His book about the U.S. government's secret counterterrorism operations is called Counterstrike. Special forces are just one part of all of this. The technology behind drones, or as the military prefers, unmanned aerial vehicles, has also changed dramatically in the last few years. Under President Bush, the U.S. used mainly the Predator drone system, which was originally designed only for surveillance. It had to be retrofitted to carry a single missile. Today, its replacement, a Reaper drone, can carry 6 missiles. Drones can fly longer. They have better surveillance capabilities. But also, says Peter Singer of the Brookings Institution,
then, of course, you also have the political side of this, the willingness to use them. That clearly has gone up in the Obama administration. I mean, essentially, if you're looking at Pakistan, we've carried out 340 strikes there total, about 290 of them during the Obama administration. So that's definitely a ramp up that can't just be focused on in terms of the technology.
Who's really behind the strikes? Is it the military or is it the CIA?
You have the overt use of these technologies in a place like Afghanistan. Then you move over to the covert side, the CIA, or it may involve JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, which is the military's version of the black world. These two different covert sides interact, but they do have different kill lists, so to speak, and sometimes you'll see public figures say, well, we don't do, for example, signature strikes, but they'll be talking about one kill list, not the other kill list.
Why doesn't the United States have just one kill list? Why do we have separate kill lists for separate government entities?
It's a good question. We live in a political world, and so you have different entities out there, the military versus the CIA. One may be exclusively focused on counterterrorism. Another one may be, for example, in Yemen, trying to figure out how to support Yemeni military and its efforts against a rebellion that's gotten mixed together with al-Qaeda. You also have, frankly, just bureaucracies that are at clash. And then people sometimes may take advantage of that, where they'll go, okay, I can't get this guy on this list, so can he make that list? That ad hoc arrangement has worked, but there are some concerns about, do we want other nations out there acting in the same way? What happens when it morphs into operations like a Yemen or maybe even one day a Syria? We've got to figure out how to put in more layers of oversight, not just within the executive branch, but Congress has to step up and play a deeper role.
With these kill lists, does President Obama always make the final call no matter what list it is?
If we believe the leaks, the president has taken on the role that previous President Bush once described of himself, and we kind of laughed. You know, he said, I'm the decider. In this case, it does appear that the president is playing that role of the ultimate decider. The concern in the long term, we might be reassured by having someone who's a former law professor taking on that role. And there's a lot of people who I think are comfortable with a president who is from their own political party, who I could imagine reacting very differently with a different president from a different political party, or maybe when it moves beyond just being about traditional al-Qaeda. Essentially, the defense that the executive branch has taken so far is they said, look, we are providing due process. It's just due process that takes place within the executive branch. That stretches the definition of due process. And as this becomes regularized, you may want Congress to play, you know, the role that the constitutional framers originally intended when we defined things like due process. The point that I'm getting at here is that it may make sense in the here and now, but when we look at it as a long-term proposition, it may fall apart as being the best possible way.
Peter Singer of the Brookings Institution. His book on modern warfare technology is called Wired for War.